I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, this is Rebecca Atkinson-Lord, and you're listening to The Legacy Tapes, a series of conversations with artistic directors talking about how you might be able to leave a legacy in the ephemeral medium of theatre. And I'm here talking to Matt Fenton, the artistic director and chief executive of Contact in Manchester. And Contact's a pretty remarkable and special organisation.
It is.
Tell me about what it was like to come here, because I think when you arrived, there were already in place some of the youth governance structures and some of the things that make this place so special. Was that a joy, or was there a weight attached to that?
My early experiences at Contact were as an audience member. Mm-hmm. So I'd had a bit of a flavour of what Contact was about. I came to see a show that Moti Roti made here, or yeah, presented here, called Aladdin, about call centres in India. Mm-hmm. And it was this multimedia piece. I'd never seen anything quite like it.
Yeah.
I came to see a forced end show here where the audience were just talking back all the way through.
Yeah.
And clearly some parts of the audience getting a bit tetchy about that. Mm-hmm. But because it had presented itself in this, there is no fourth wall, hi, I'm Jerry, I'm just going to saunter onto stage in my jeans and say hi. Why wouldn't the audience say hi back?
Yeah.
And why would they not continue with that established conversation yeah, all the way through the show? Which I found really exciting,
yeah,
having seen that work through a kind of live art or this is art, shut up and listen type frame, then just see it somewhere where the audience enters into dialogue with it immediately. Proper, interesting and exciting. So anyway, that was kind of early experience of Contact. And of course, aware in the audience, as I remain aware of its youth and its diversity, that you kind of feel the moment you're in the foyer.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Oh, okay.
It doesn't feel like any other theatre I walk through.
And you pick that vibe up really quickly and definitely in the foyer before a show. Mm. And then my experience of the interview process was amazing, really, because then you know these statements that Contact makes about itself, about putting young people at the heart of everything, and you kind of go, okay, yeah, whatever. And then my interview, you know, my main memory is of the young people's panel, whose first question to me was, what's the most interesting thing that has ever happened to you? So from the moment you're in the interview, everything you've prepared is of no use. And you kind of go, oh, shit, what is the most interesting thing that's ever happened to me? And then you're off on a track that you did not plan. I started talking about very personal things to start with, and eventually we spoke about theatre and stuff, but it got off on that different tack.
And that's an incredibly smart question.
And that's amazing, because actually a board would have asked me a predictable question, and I would have given a predictable answer. And then actually whoever had been most effective at that rather predictable set of questions and responses, which never go off piste, would have got the job. And what's interesting about that?
Yeah.
One of those young people, Afrina, is now on the board. So I answer to her in a very real sense now. But I still feel that actually in my job, I'm carrying the excitement of that interview process and how real it was. Now, of course, since I now understand, which I didn't really at the time, that a young people's panel is central to every permanent appointment, and that the young panel have equal weighting to the staff, exec or board panel that is making the appointment. And I mean equal weighting. Yeah. So if both panels don't agree, we do a second round.
Okay.
Or we do we re-advertise and re-interview. And I've seen that in action. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is most of the time, but not all the time, the two panels agree. We don't know, you know, as exec, we don't know what question is the young panel are going to ask, you know, someone who's applied for a job as a senior project manager here. We only find out when the two panels convene what each panel has asked and what came out of those interview questions. The same pertains to programming. So four young people and four members of staff essentially become the programming team. I'm one of those eight people, and I have about an eighth input into what the program will be. So there's really interesting provocations in that about artistic leadership, choice and taste,
yeah,
and perhaps about how we might think about diversity.
Yeah.
Because that collective is diverse, no one person within it is, and me as a white middle class arts manager is certainly not, you know, I'm certainly not pushing our definition of what that role might look like.
And it totally challenges the hierarchy of taste and how we think about value in art, right?
Completely, yeah, completely. So, you know, when I'm reflecting on what Contact has done in the 2.5-3 years I've been here, it's really clear to me that my job has been to know a good idea when I heard it and then support that idea, not have the ideas.
Phew.
Because you wouldn't have got to a piece with Inua and Benji about basketball, or Commonwealth's piece about young female Muslim boxers, or a piece we've just made with Great Manchester Police about all kinds of abuse in particular communities, or Big Girls Blouse, the experience of growing up transgender in the Midlands in the 70s, or .. you name it.
Yeah.
You know, none of those shows are my worldview, my idea or my taste. And if it were my job to try and imagine what those projects might be or imagine those stories, I'd just get it wrong in a really kind of inauthentic, crass way. That's not my job.
Yeah.
My job is to bring together diverse groups of people to come up with these ideas, and the artists are at the core of that always. So... and young people.
Yeah. So tell me what that means for, like, what's Contact legacy? What's the trail that's left behind that?
I mean, I'm very aware of the impact Contact has had on the sector. So the number of people that I engage with and work with, actors, directors, makers, writers, companies, but also stage managers, technicians, artistic directors, execs, you know, across the board, the ridiculous number that have come through Contact at one point, but also cite it as an important organisation, because I think you don't spend much time here without being influenced and marked by it. So, of course, you know, every theatre has, you know, hundreds of people going through, but it really seems to be a pattern for me, the number of people that are marked and influenced and changed by the experience of working at Contact, and I totally know I have been and will be. So it feels like the legacy is in the people, in those practices and in those approaches, and in the ethos of those people, that is particularly exciting. I don't really think about the legacy in terms of the work produced, but that is another kind of legacy, you know. But I think it is in the embodied knowledge, practice, ethos of those people out there working.
And I guess in the demonstration effect, to use a banking term, you know, like... This organisation is a tangible example of how doing things differently works. How if you let the people that you want to speak to be in charge of how you're speaking, you'll probably be better at it.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. So, you know, Contact hasn't been... well, it hasn't gone bust, and the building hasn't fallen over. You know...
You sound so surprised, well, you're the chief exec.
Because, actually, people... because, you know, it's kind of committed to a model that... I'm trying to find ways constantly to keep that faith in young people as decision makers alive, but also keep it fresh, and not just keep repeating the same models, but to kind of hold that legacy of that early decision 20 years ago to let's look at governance differently.
And you...
but what surprises me maybe is that not more people haven't done other experiments, either adopted this model or others, or played with others or experimented with others. And I guess institutions are such difficult things to change at fundamental level, at governance level. They change so slowly. And Contact did a really brave, bold thing, which was really just to kind of redraw it all, you know, to sort of start again in terms of how it was going to think about who got to decide what happened.
Because people in power don't want to give up their power.
Yeah, perhaps it's that. I mean, yeah, people aren't going to structure themselves out of existence, even if they may be aware that they're sat in seats that other people might bring more to, which is another kind of thinking about legacy, isn't it? You know, what the legacy of these roles and who, you know, which kind of people might populate them in future, or will those roles even, and should they even exist? The role of artistic director of a building being case in point.
Yeah, I think there's something really interesting about just in talking about legacy, at some point I'll do a version of one of these with Rachel and I, my co-director at Oval House, and she, when I first raised it with her, was really uncomfortable because she didn't like to think of it in such an egotistical, she didn't like to think of such an egotistical thing as legacy, but actually legacy might be removing yourself from the picture.
Yeah.
You know, it isn't yeah. necessarily an ego-based, although it often is, thing. Do you come across lots of, or any resistance to the structures now? Like, when you're talking to people who aren't used to the organisation or familiar with it?
Yeah, I think, to an extent, I mean, we need to be careful that we don't also mythologise Contact and pretend it is doing what it isn't.
Mm.
So, you know, that we still have paid staff. I'm still paid as chief exec and AD.
Are the young people paid?
They are paid expenses. If they're on a panel, they're paid to be on that panel. But they're not paid a salary.
Mm.
So, you know, there's an unevenness to that.
Mm.
And then the young people who are really at the top end of the young people, age-wise, that we work with, who are on our board, again, you know, that the board role is a voluntary one.
Yeah.
And a responsible one.
Mm.
So, you know, we can't pretend that Contact is a venue that is run by volunteers or is run day in, day out by young people.
Mm.
It's that it has structures that genuinely enable young people to inform what it does, what shows it presents, but even, you know, what architects it appoints for a refurb or the firm of auditors that it appoints to do its accounts.
Mm.
All those things are similarly, you know, have a young people's decision-making kind of part of that process. So that's amazing and radical, but also for me it's not that scary, it's not that radical,
yeah.
actually. So I do wonder therefore why so few other organisations have looked at how do we bring even our users, even our audiences, much more into the decision making mix of what we do.
Why, you know, do you think they haven't?
I don't know. I think it's going to be a mix of things. I mean, one will be institutional nervousness.
Mm.
The other will be the kind of mythologizing of the role of artistic director as expert, or as the supreme arbiter of taste.
Mm.
Others will be more about, oh well, what will happen to the box office if our very carefully prepared thinking and modeling about what that box office will look like is then just thrown to the wind and we just let any old Herbert have an opinion about what we should be presenting.
Yeah.
That the perception that is maybe really risky, and of course not all institutions have the same level of risk. So Contact, and you know, I check our privilege in terms of the amount of public subsidy we receive.
Mm.
We're in a different situation to a commercial venue.
Mm.
If it makes a few of those wrong decisions, we'll just shut.
Yeah.
And similarly, we're 320 seats. That's a very different set of questions for someone that's 1500 seats.
Yeah.
So, you know, what I'm not saying is, why does everyone not adopt a model like Contact? What I'm saying, really, or what I'm interested in, is why so few people think and play with and adopt and come up with alternative models that are appropriate to their scale, funding mix, kind of commercial model, but that nonetheless bring them much closer to an openness about what our programme might look like or what our activity might be and who informs that, who gets to decide what gets commissioned, what gets programmed, what gets produced, where we deliver our projects, etc.
It's really interesting you just talk about people being distrustful of letting any old Herbert choose what's programmed, because really any old Herbert chooses what's successful because they're the people that buy the tickets, right? Like,
yeah,
it's just about moving that choice from for, like, earlier into the process, right?
Yeah, the people can spot quality really quickly, and people can tell the difference between pretension and complexity really quickly.
Mm.
In, you know, so yeah, my kids, you know, your gran, anyone can really sense and intuit, and may feel they don't have the language to express, but definitely can sense and intuit the difference between pretentiousness and something that I don't quite understand but has integrity.
Yeah, crunchiness.
Yeah, and also, I mean, I'm, you know, thinking about legacy. The projects that I did in Lancaster, where I was previously, that really brought me to Contact, I think the dotted line is really clear to me in hindsight about why I'm doing this job. Those projects that defined my time in Lancaster, certainly for me, were the ones where I helped or facilitated other people to decide what the programme was, and those became the most successful projects I did while I was there. At its most extreme, that was a year out that I took in 2007, 2008, where first artists programmed a season. Certainly in terms of box office, but I think just in terms of how good the programme was, that was my most successful autumn programme in 9 years there. And then local residents that we recruited through the local paper programmed spring 2008, and then again was the most successful spring programme that I presented while I was there, which for me is brilliant. It was an amazing project. And then for me, I never really went back to a traditional view of programming and producing as one person's decision about what would happen. You know, for me, there wasn't really any going back after that project.
Because if you want to speak to multiple tastes, you need to program with multiple tastes.
Seems
so sensible once you see it work.
Yeah, exactly that. So I went straight from that project into a gallery program that was children curating the gallery, and then we did a project with the support staff, with security, porters, technicians curating the gallery, you know, and just then from that point on just started playing with, oh, what? Anyone can decide, not just the person whose job says they should. Anyone can do it. Oh, okay, where does that take you? And for me, that takes you to contact for now. So in hindsight, it's quite interesting that for me there is a legacy of playing with and thinking about models of curation and models of programming that now actually what started there as a project that became something over time, that's now really my day job, is actually explicitly to do that.
So I think I'm going to say something that I don't actually agree with, but I just need to ask the question. So we're recording this just after the EU referendum.
Mm-hmm.
It'll probably go out much later than that. And I've always believed in the power of any informed human being to make a good informed choice, until this week. Sometimes as artists or as theatre makers, it's our job to educate and scooch taste and social perceptions along a bit. If you let any Herbert program, can you do that as effectively? That's my question.
Yeah, okay. So I've got two kind of thoughts and responses to that. That's a really fair question. That in the EU referendum, information and misinformation we were given, it didn't feel to me that we were ever presented with the simple facts of this is what the EU is, as opposed to Europe, as opposed to the Euro.
Yes.
This is what the EU is.
Mm-hmm.
This is when we joined.
Mm-hmm.
This is its constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So that I even knew what I was voting about.
Mm.
You know, this is what our membership requires of us, and this is what we get from it. No different from any other member of the EU. Just to understand what it is we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think this referendum even got to that point, which is why so many people after voting are going, actually, I wonder what is it that I voted
Let
on?
Me just
actually,
Google that.
Can I just check?
Yeah.
And then and you said any reasonable person presented with the facts or presented with the information. Well, then that didn't happen either. Mm-hmm. All we got was this kind of jostling of kind of half lies, misinformation, things presented as facts that were then kind of, you know, revealed as being highly contentious opinions, and it just became this blurry mishmash. So actually what you got expressed through the voting process, I suspect, is prejudice more than and prejudice in any in whatever direction you have that. You could have a liberal prejudice, but that's what you got expressed through the voting process, but not really a decision based on facts and informed opinions. I suspect it's maybe interesting then just leave that for a sec and think about how our young programmers program here. Well, actually, they don't come out of nowhere, those young people, so we don't run chasing after people on the street that look interesting and say, hey, would you like to program a theatre? The young people that have engaged with us as poets or young musicians or young performers in our company, or they might have been part of a community project we did in North Manchester. You know, multiple different ways than person might have first got engaged with us mm-hmm. before they'd have even heard about Contact or the fact that you can program that as a young person. So they don't come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And so all of those projects, so, you know, you might say, well, networks, they're already susceptible to be interested in creativity, even if at that point their own.
Yeah.
They've already had the gumption to join one of those projects, all of which are free, none of which you have to audition for in any formal sense to get involved in, so they're quite low barriers to engagement, and a huge amount are delivered off-site, because we acknowledge an arts building is itself a barrier. So, you know, though our young programmers are drawn from that kind of pool of young people. The other thing that all of those projects feed you into is seeing shows in the programme. So they start to see a load of work, and that work is both here and elsewhere in the city. So they begin to form an opinion.
Yeah.
So they begin to know what they do and don't like, what they do and don't respect, what they think is authentic and inauthentic. So before they've even joined the young programming team, they've got all of that. And then the first thing that that group then does is go to Edinburgh. So our young programming team is called Recon. First thing they do is go to Edinburgh together, see as much work as it's possible to see in about 5 days, and then talk about it.
Yeah.
So then they begin to get a shared sense of what they each like, don't like, and talk
and
about that.
A critical vocabulary.
And a vocabulary in which to talk about what they have seen and what they think about it. And it isn't until they've done all that that we'd ever dream of saying, and what do you think of Contact, and what would you like to start going to see as part of this programme? And what do you think that you've seen at Contact has been great? What do you like to see more of? What do you think's missing? What shows have you seen that you'd like, or which artists do you think have got potential for you? Which is the most exciting artist you saw when you're in Edinburgh, and then, you know, and all the things in the autumn as they start to see work actually as the young programmers. And it's only after all of that that they're starting to make or have ideas and suggestions that might a year later become the programme.
So you're building your ideal citizens.
Yeah. Maybe that. I mean, you never think about it in that way.
For like the state of Contact, you know.
But it's, you know, all of that is preparation for them to kind of, and none of it's telling them what they should and shouldn't like, but it is giving them
the tools to know,
and then to be able to express that opinion in an open way. And then, so they really don't come out of nowhere. We shouldn't pretend that they do.
Good. Yeah. Good answer.
That answers your question about the EU.
Yes. I mean, it sort of does. It was just.
But I guess we had none of the preparation to have that debate in an informed way.
Yeah, because we're not even, you know, I'm one of those ridiculously politically obsessed people, and even I'm not as informed as though, you know, as the analogy.
Exactly. And nor am I. Exactly, because our culture and our politicians have not facilitated that. They've not enabled us to have a clear, rational understanding of what it means to be in the EU.
Do you think if it feels like Contact is doing something that quite innovative in terms of its context elsewhere in ecology, are you constantly shooting for the new and different, or are you like, okay, this works, let's not balls it up? That's a false binary, right?
Yeah.
But where are you on the scale?
I don't think we ever ask those questions. I don't think we use a language that is about innovation. We're probably talking about it in other ways. I also don't think that we're chasing the new for its own sake. I think we're really interested in the underrepresented, and creating space for that to pop through and flourish and be expressed. But even then, I'm not sure to what extent we're consciously thinking that. I think that we adopt structures that enable that to be possible or more likely than traditional top-down structures. So I think it's a kind of a leap of faith and a belief in a methodology, or a set of methodologies that enable and produce possibility, but you're not trying to control what that is. And I think that's really similar to a lot of art makers that I most enjoy and like, that their process is not starting with, okay, well, this is what it's going to look and sound like, let's work back from that and build it. They're really creating spaces of opportunity, possibility, play, improvisation, connection, random association, and through that process, even if that process is quite rigid, that produces stuff that is not plannable at the outset. And I think we're trying to do something similar.
But
we certainly don't have a brief for our programme or for the work that we commission that it should be radical or innovative or even new. It just is.
Just is.
But not in its own but not as an end in itself. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're trying to be innovative, you know. Yeah. And everyone has a different opinion about what is and isn't innovative anyway. Yeah.
It feels like you're not so end... Maybe I might be wrong. You're not so end focused. Like, I feel like in my experience of contact, it's much more been about this is how we want to be together.
Exactly.
And the output will be what it is.
But that's why, yeah, exactly. And that's why I describe how programming happens. We talk about programming because I'm the AD, but you know, the program is what comes out of the process of engaging with a group of young people, going to see some work together, and talking about it. Mm-hmm. The program comes out of that. I can't tell you what will come out of it. What will come out of it is interesting,
yeah,
and we'll present it,
yeah,
but I can't tell you what it will be or what it will look like. And I think that's great, because that's how, you know, we are able to present work fairly early in its gestation, and we're able to present artists that maybe not everyone has heard of yet, but they will in 5 years time. But we're not seeking that as an end in its own right. I think we're doing it for other reasons, which is to do with representation, to do with diversity, to do with multiple voices being presented and access routes being multiple, both in and out of the programme. And then a leap of faith that the audience will reflect that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting to me. Mm. So actually, you know, you look at our young people, young programmes, our participants, the diversity, their diversity is reflected in the programme and in the audience. And it's not, you know, for me, that is not that complex to see that work. And that's really important for me to do it in that direction. So to look at the diversity of the decision makers, that produces a programme. The programme is delivered in the belief that that will attract diverse, multiple audiences to engage with it, rather than the other way, which is to go, who's missing? Who do we think we should be attracting? Or who do we want to attract?
Mm.
What programme will most attract them? And then, okay, so then what will I program to deliver that?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we get inauthentic, that's where we get it wrong, that's where we make assumptions about the kinds of things particular audiences might want to see or engage with.
That's the order most.
And it tracks it all back to one person and their taste. And that's why we get it wrong, I think, or why we fail to diversify very much, no matter how hard we think we're trying.
Mm.
And in all of this, again, it's important to say, Contact as a staff body is not where it should be in terms of diversity. You know, our staffing structures, the people that work here in full-time permanent employment are less diverse than our kind of young teams and then our audience.
Why do you think that is?
I think there's a couple of things. One is that Contact is probably similarly guilty to a lot of the sector about using the same means to recruit, advertise and appoint staff. I mean, when it gets to Contact, once we get those applicants, you go through a very different journey than another. But in terms of
getting them,
the pool of people out there, despite what Contact and other other organisations do to engage and empower young people to consider the arts as a space for them to work in, that's still quite a narrow pool, and it feels like that may even be narrowing given what's happening in education.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels like we're really swimming against the stream in that sense. You know, you have to be really proactive, really targeted, really focused on ensuring that you're doing everything you possibly can to make sure that you're getting diverse pools of applicants. And I think Contact is struggling in that, as the rest of the sector clearly is. I think we're better than some, if not better than most, but we're not where we should be. And so, actually, for us, that's what we're focusing on at the moment.
So much of what you talk about has this underlying agenda for social change and a sense of kind of core values and ethics. At the heart of the organisation, really cynically or not, because I don't know what I think, but can theatre change the world? And second part of the question, why do you do this for a job?
So the first point, I mean, I don't have grand claims to make for the power of art to change the world, but what I do think and I do see is art changing and empowering people who go on to do unpredictable and amazing things, either individually or collectively.
Mm-hmm.
And I see the work that Contact does do that first bit.
Yeah. Archery, so, just people train for the world.
Yeah. And so I... So that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. So I think that, you know, the answer to the second question is in the first part. And contact does, you know, it does demonstrate to you on a pretty regular basis the amazing ability of the arts to unlock potential in someone. For us, that's in young people predominantly, but in anyone. And that to flourish in pretty amazing ways. And also what's amazing is how quickly that flourishing can take place for a project. It is kind of amazing. Especially, and this is where I really get maybe down on the sector again, especially if you let go of the art.
Mm.
So your question in many ways makes me think about the agency, which is a project we're doing with Battersea Arts Centre in London and ourselves in Manchester, which takes a creative devising process, kind of making methodology from theatre, a process adopted from Rio. So, you know, it's a methodology developed in the favelas in Rio by an artist called Marcus Faustini. Anyway, it takes his playful devising improvisatory practice, but rather than making shows with that, you use that process to develop startups, social enterprises, micro businesses, whatever that group of young people want to kind of come up with.
Yeah.
And so you devise social enterprises rather than devise shows. What's interesting to me is really effective. It's brilliant. And just as, you know, just as with the rest of Contact's programme, it produces ideas and projects that we, as a staff body, could never come up with. So the kind of things that have come out of the agency from this theatre process.
Yeah.
You know, it's a baking programme called Crumbs, which is a young person running baking workshops for families that access food banks and the ingredients sourced that way. A board game, a bit like the Game of Life, called Life is What You Make It, about the experience of growing up on the Winstanley Estate in London. An ethical fashion line that uses African fabrics, but also the woman that runs it, Rosemary, like the seamstress skills of her aunts and her gran and things, you know, and uses those skills to produce really beautifully made fashion. So, you know, none of those are ideas that we, as theatre makers, at Contact, would ever have come up with. But they're amazing, they're really brilliant, and they're not saying they're changing the world, but they're absolutely important community projects that are changing those communities, and especially the lives of the young people that come up with those ideas and are now running them.
They're changing the world for those people.
So, yeah, exactly. In a small way, I think absolutely they are. And the art is doing that. So, you know, I think that's amazing. I think it's interesting that perhaps our arts funders, or our most art output focused funders, were the last to really see the value of that project, although I definitely think that's coming along too, because it speaks so strongly to this question, well, what can art do other than produce plays and exhibitions and things in buildings? So yeah, it's projects like that I'm working here, you know. I think there's something really exciting about that, and again, it's not... What's radical and innovative is not the idea.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is one you can get your head around in 5 minutes. It's that it actually is done, it is committed to, and there is absolutely no pressure on any of those young people to come and see a show or make a play or something. I think what's innovative is the letting go of the desire for it to be art, to be audience development in any way.
I guess it's about imagination and creativity in any way you choose to apply it.
Yeah. And that those applications go well beyond the arts.
Mm.
In fact, immediately go beyond the arts if you relax about the art.
Yeah.
And in a good way.
You've sort of talked a little bit about being critical of the ecology or the industry. If you could, in really simplistic terms, right, because nothing is that simple, if you could wave a magic wand and give the world or the industry or a single person or anything, elicit a change and have something be different on any scale of your choosing, what would it be?
I think it would be the job description of every single artistic director in the country.
Mm.
So that when our boards or whatever appointment structures we have come to appoint, this is why we think about legacy maybe, we're looking for a different set of skills, a different kinds of sets of experience and different kinds of ability to populate those roles.
Because
I think if that doesn't happen, a lot of the agendas that we're been talking about engaging, about genuine participation, about genuine community, about representation, about diversity, about empowerment, those things are just going to move along at a snail's pace. Mm-hmm. And if we think that society is at certain times working against those forces, then we're kind of fucked.
John McGrath this morning was talking about the frustrations of evolution rather than revolution.
Exactly. Evolution takes bloody ages.
Millennia.
Yeah. And also, it doesn't necessarily evolve in the way you want. If you're just nudging it along, it doesn't necessarily evolve in liberal ways either.
And it's growing in response to stimuli that might not be healthy stimuli, I suppose. You know, you just... So it can... I'm thinking about something... growing, well, you know, you can grow all wonky if the rock's
totally.
In the way.
Yeah, totally.
Doesn't mean it's the right way.
Yeah.
And probably the last thing, what do you want your personal legacy to be? And I don't just mean at Contact. I mean, when it comes to writing your obituary, what is the thing that you want it to say that you left behind?
I never think about it. I don't think I have that kind of ego. I mean, I'm not really interested. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the people I'm engaging with now, the young people we're working with and we'll work with next, the artists we're supporting, funding, presenting. If all of that collectively in however many years' time becomes a legacy, then brilliant. Mm. But I don't think I'm interested in even guessing what that might be. I'm honestly not bothered. But I think that's the kind of, you know, that's the kind of role I'm interested in fulfilling at AED level.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm interested in the effect I'm having on, you know, a set of individuals that I'm currently working with.
Mm.
Cumulatively over time, that might look like a body of work or something. I'm not thinking about the legacy. But maybe that's also, maybe so I'm not thinking about it yet.
That is the legacy.
Okay, well, it is, all right, great. But I also just think, well, legacy is not the reason you do something. That's not the reason you get out of bed. I think, you know, the reason you get out of bed is, or for me, is that... we're involved in loads of really great projects. I want to see what happens. I want to hear what everyone I'm about to meet has got to say. I want to see the outcome of the projects that we're supporting. And I guess I'm interested in provoking and encouraging others to be more open about how they run their organisations.
Mm.
So some of the things that I've written or have done have definitely... the audience that I have in mind for those interventions, it is almost always other leaders, mm-hmm. other ADs. And even the programming experiment I did in 2007 with artist local residents, even then, when I look back, I spoke about that as a provocation to other artistic leaders about their jobs. That's what I was thinking. If there was an audience for that experiment, that was the audience I was thinking about. So maybe that's also thinking maybe a kind of legacy, but only really in the sense of, well, what impact might you have to inspire different ways of working, and also to show that what might be perceived as a risk is not actually that risky. And if you do it authentically and commit to a process and see it through, sometimes it can actually be brilliant. It can produce much better results than you can just come up with on your own in your own room, you know.
Yeah,
so what's the risk in the end? And actually, the greater risk is that you don't engage, that you don't open up, that you don't consider power as something to be spread, shared. And I still acknowledge in all of that, I still get a salary, you know, and the participants in a community project we work with are not, unless they're performing in a professional show. So I understand there's still disparities in that. Nonetheless, I think the job is to spread the power, not to hoard it.
Mm. So I think maybe I need to be better at defining legacy, because I don't know what I mean when I ask these questions, right?
So does everyone you've interviewed just go, oh, I don't think about it?
It really depends, and actually it totally changes based on the kind of organisation they run.
Yeah.
And the kind of person they are and what their value system is.
Yes.
So some people are absolutely, I want my legacy to be this.
Yeah.
There is a theme that is that the legacy resides in people, and that, you know, it could be about hundreds of young people empowered to be creative and have creative agency in a way that they never would have been if something didn't exist, if you hadn't done that thing. Or it could be about often it's about, you know, the audiences, so these people get to experience something, and that shifts, that causes a shift within them, and who knows what that shift will mean. Mm-hmm. So I think often there's something about legacy residing in people, which is why when you say it, I was like, no, but that's it.
Yeah, okay, well, fair enough.
Because I think whenever you talk about, I see you talk a lot at conferences and things, and you're always with one of your young participants, and I think that itself feels like such a revolutionary act, especially at the really traditional ones where kind of people are worrying about the colour of velvet on the chairs rather than the fundamental structures that underpin the ecology, you know. Just demonstrating that's a possible and healthy way of being feels really revolutionary.
And I guess just at contact we forget that, because that feels really normal,
just what you do.
Well, why wouldn't we, because we say, well, why wouldn't we try to do what we say we do? Is that what's radical, that we actually try to do that? But it's always the thing that people most respond to as well, so we get positive reinforcement that that's a good thing to do. So you know, the conference we were last at that Felucia spoke, but it's important that she gets more of a platform than me, that in many ways I'm introducing her. And we did exactly the same at the event for the agency with the House of Lords, so the people that would normally give speeches introduced a young person who then spoke. And we do the same when we report to our funders, so you know, we report to City Council and AGMA, Association of Greater Manchester Authorities. The last annual report we did was two colleagues and a young person, and we introduced the young person who said, and now they're going to talk about projects that they've been involved on that you funded. Why would they not want to hear from them? And of course those politicians don't really have many questions for us. They're like, did you submit your figures on time, and did you hit your KPIs?
mostly
and then all of their other questions are for the young people. Of course they are. You know, because they're young people from the parts of the city that they're from.
Interesting.
And that's what they funded. Why on earth would we not do that? You know, but again, that gets spoken about. Oh, it's so amazing that you did that. Oh, it's so radical you did that.
But people don't.
Because we don't prep them. That's the thing to be totally open about. They could say anything. Yeah. Hopefully, they have a good time and they say that.
Yeah. But that is, because no one, I haven't ever seen anybody else do that. And yet, the thing that we all know and the thing that we all say in our industry is that the best way to change the dialogue is for the people that have the habitual power to shut the fuck up.
And the people that value it to speak of that value. Yeah, totally. But I think often, but that's why what seems so radical to me about contact is that it does what it says on the tin. And why, you know, that's interesting, isn't it? That's my experience of my whole first year was one of just going, whoa, they really do it. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, they say that and they do that. Okay,
that's true.
That's interesting. And that, of course, it's not. It's not utopian, it's not in every case, but you know, there is this commitment that is seen through, and that should see radical is a bit of a shame, because loads of people say loads of things. It's like you just want them to do that thing they say they do. And you know, contact doesn't always deliver. Of course it doesn't.
But at least,
you know, we're fallible, but there is this repeated attempt to commit to that. And what I will say is that, you know, the people that experience it reinforce that and encourage it and say, oh, well, we really loved hearing from that young person, or the highlight of that conference was when that young person got up and spoke or gave a poem or rapped or did something unexpected but spoke, and that is often kind of reflected back to us as the way in which we best communicate what we do. And I kind of think, well, yeah, cool. Of course it is.
I read a really interesting thing online the other day about how one of the best ways to secure your power as a gatekeeper is to say you're good at diversity. And I was like, that's terrifying. And it was said in there are all of these organisations that say we work with these amazing and diverse participants to give them a voice, without ever acknowledging that they have a voice and you should shut up.
Crikey. Right, that's the most depressing thing I've heard in a while. Okay.
Sorry, I didn't mean to bring depression. I didn't mean to bring depression at all. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Pleasure, thank you.